Chapter 10. Zerash. Souls can no more see the origins of their thought than they can see the backs of their heads or the insides of their entrails. And since souls cannot differentiate what they cannot see, there is a peculiar sense in which the soul cannot self-differentiate. So it is always, in a peculiar sense, the same time when they think, the same place where they think, and the same individual who does the thinking. Like tipping a spiral on its side until only a circle can be seen, the passage of moments always remains now, the carnival of spaces always sojourns here, and the succession of people always becomes me. The truth is, if the soul could apprehend itself the way it apprehended the world, if it could apprehend its origins, it would see that there is no now, there is no here, and there is no me. In other words, it would realize that just as there is no circle, there is no soul. Memgawa, Celestial Aphorisms. You are fallen from him like sparks from the flame. A dark wind blows, and you are soon to flicker out. Songs 633, The Chronicle of the Tusk. Early Spring, 4112, Year of the Tusk. Zerash. The long mule trains of the Scarlet Spires finally arrived several days into the siege of Garotha. As though on cue, a new embassy issued from the city, this one walking in the manner of abject petitioners. The gates were not closed behind them. As the warrior prophet had promised, the ancient capital of Zerash had capitulated of her own accord. As a gift, the embassy brought the 12 heads of those who had orchestrated the earlier closing of the gates, including that of Captain Heberata, who had mortally offended the warrior prophet. But the lords of the holy war were not appeased, and the warrior prophet spoke harshly to the Garothans, saying that some example had to be set, some sacrifice made, both to atone for and to warn against what had happened. As though justice were to be found in the clarity of proportion, he announced his toll of days, saying that since 4 days had passed since Garotha had shut its gates against him, so 4 out of 10 Garothans had to forfeit their lives. By dawn's light tomorrow, he decreed, 20,000 heads must be hung from the battlements of your city walls. If you do not do this, verily you shall all perish. That night, while the holy war celebrated, all Garotha screamed. Dawn's light found her walls slicked in blood, their entire circuit ornamented with severed heads, thousands of them, either bundled in fishing nets or strung through the jaw along hanging ropes of hemp. When the heads were counted, it was found that the Garothans had exceeded their measure by 3,056. In all of Zerash, no city, town, or fortress would bar her gates against the holy war again. Athgieri, meanwhile, became the first lord of the holy war to enter the sacred lands. Some time passed before he and his gainry realized they had actually entered Holy Emotu. There was little to distinguish the Zerashi, or the Sons of Shaikol, as they called them, from the Amati in appearance or tongue. They crossed the tablelands of Jarta, whose people had once waged generational war against the ancient Amati, then descended into a war of their own. With no more than 500 thanes and knights, Athgieri battled his way ever deeper into Holy Emotu. His sunburned Galioth found the Amati to be treacherous and supportive by turns. Though most called themselves Fainim, they had no love of the Kianine, and after months of dreadful rumors, many thought the idolaters and their false prophet invincible. The Padi Raja himself had fallen. The great Kaskamandri was dead. And here came none other than the mercurial kinsman of Saudun, the ruthless blonde beast of Anathpania. There were encounters at Gim, the famed Anothrite shrine, Mer Parasis. Athgieri himself was wounded in the knee at Garama, where the latter prophet's mother had been born. Soon their blood-smeared standard, a circumfix over the red horse of Gainry, became a general sign of panic and terror. And though Fenial sent more and more of his grandees to hunt him, the Earl of Gainry either vanished or, even worse, prevailed. Hural Arkit, the desert men began to call him, the wind has teeth. Finally, on the Day of Palms, the ironclad knights rode into Besral, the ancestral home of the latter prophet's now extinct line. Though the Enrithi mission had fled long ago, many Amati gathered to cheer the haggard wayfarers. For such hearts, they told one another, had to be holy. They walked before him, talking as though oblivious to Akamian's presence mere paces behind, Esmanet and Kellis. What was already being called the Toll of Days had been exacted, and the city was strangely mute, either for the want of voices or out of collective shock. Along the visible length of the alley, onlookers shrank or fell to their knees. The Zarashi in particular were careful to keep their black-ringed eyes to the ground as the sacral retinue filed past. The warrior prophet toured Garotha as much to be seen, Akamian imagined, as to inspect his prize. In the tractate, Garotha was sometimes called the City of 100 Villages, and after 2,000 years, the epithet still suited. The alleys were as narrow and as numerous as those of the Worm in Carathuzel. But unlike the Worm, where the ways followed the illogic of countless disconnected decisions over countless years, these continually converged onto what the Zarashi called smalls, miniature bazaars where the sun actually baked the cobbles, as if Garotha were indeed a collection of intertwined villages grown into one another, like spots of mold on bread. Esmanet had been telling Kellis of her morning audience with the Scarlet Spires. According to Sarnemi, routine remained the rule in Jaktha, either because or in spite of the Skilvendi's harsh ways. Otherwise, Eleazaris claimed to have spoken to Palatine Uranyanka personally, warning him of the arcane consequences of any sedition, perceived or otherwise. "The Grand Master," she said, "wanted me to assure you that the Palatine of Mozorothu will cause you no more troubles." Akamian could only watch and listen with dismay and admiration. It was a marvel to see her thus. There was her appearance, of course, her hair pinned in a jeweled brace, her gown, a Kianine chiton, sewn for the courts and pleasure gardens of the White Sun Palace in Nensophon. But there was her bearing as well, upright, guileless, penetrating and ironic. She was a match, and an easy one at that, for her newfound station. It made breathing difficult. "I have to stop this." Before, it had been just the two of them. Before, he could simply reach out, place a relaxed hand upon her waist, and she would turn into his arms. Now, everything had been put to rout. Somehow, Kellis had become the center, the way station that all must cross to find one another, to find themselves. Somehow everything had been dragged into the brilliant light of his judgment, and now Akamian found himself trailing after them like some heartbroken beggar. Why would she call him strong? "Eleazaris insulted you," Kellis said, turning to her so that Akamian could see his bearded profile. He wore a magnificent-sleeved gabardine over his tunic, an ornamental version of those worn by the Girgashi, with vertical bands of gold that flashed whenever he walked through sunlight. It looked altered about the shoulders, as one might expect, given the dead Padi Raja's reputed bulk. "He fairly called me a whore," Esmanet said. "You should expect such, your unfamiliar coin to them." Her smile was bland and cynical. "So, where's the money changer?" Kellis laughed. Akamian watched the gratification break across the faces of those about him. Some of them laughed as well, creating a melancholy echo. Everywhere Kellis went, a part of him passed through others, like a stone tossed into calm waters. "Men are simple," he replied. "They think primarily in terms of things, not relations. This is why they think it's the gold or silver that makes coins valuable, not the obedience they command. Tell them the Nilnameshi use pottery for their coins and they scoff." "Or," Esmanet said, "that the warrior prophet uses a woman." A sliver of sunshine flickered across her, and for an instant everything about her, from the pleats along her chiton to her red-painted lips, gleamed silk. The two of them seemed something otherworldly in that moment. Too beautiful, too pure for the dingy brick and unkempt hearts that surrounded them. "Exactly," Kella said. They ask, where's the gold? He grinned at her sidelong. Or, in your case, where's the thumb? Esmanet said ruefully. Thumb. Sumni slang for phallus. Why did it pain him so, listening to her speak in the old way? Kellis grinned. They can't see that gold is only relevant insofar as it plays a role within our expectations, insofar as we make it relevant. He paused, his eyes sparkling with mirth. The same, he continued, might be said of thumbs. Esmanet grimaced. Even one named Eleazarus? The sacral retinue had crowded to a stop. They had come to one of the many smalls that knotted the labyrinthine alleyways of Garotha. Blank faces seemed to watch from every window. A few men of the Tusk gazed adoring from their knees. The ever-present guardsmen of the Hundred Pillars stood pensive, staring down adjoining alleys as though they could see around corners. Someone had painted lotus vine along the weathered cornices of several buildings. A babe cried. Shaking his leonine head, the warrior prophet laughed to the heavens, and though a commune could feel the laughter's contagion, its preternatural demand to celebrate things great and small, grief struck all breath from him. Anasarimber Esmanet glanced about, her look shy with joy. Her eyes clicked away the instant she met his desolate gaze. She took her husband's hand. Karioth, the ancient stronghold of the Zarashi kings. The lords of the Holy War gathered in its ruined halls, staring about in wonder and impatience as they awaited their warrior prophet. A commune overheard Palatine Gedeki claiming that King Shykol's raving could be heard on the night wind. He saw a man, some client of Gothielk's, gathering chips of marble into a cloth. As the only feature visible above Garotha's black curtain walls, a commune had found himself pondering Karioth from the first day of the Holy War siege. He knew it had been abandoned with the ascendancy of the Thousand Temples in the days of the Canaan Empire, but he had always assumed that the Fainim would have demolished it. Afterward, he would learn from Geamakri that the Kianine actually revered it as one of their holiest shrines. And why not, when so many in Rethi thought it the very heart of malevolence? The original walls had been pulled down, so that from within, Garotha's bone-colored expanse could be clearly seen. The voluptuous imprint of Nilnamesh was unmistakable, in the bellied columns and pilasters, in the curving stairs that ended nowhere, and in the four-winged kifrang that flanked every threshold. Even roofless and ruined, the architecture seemed overheavy, though in a manner strangely at odds with the post and lintel monstrosities of ancient Kyrenius or Shygek. The surviving shoulder arches proved that the antique Zarashi builders had understood the rudiments of stress and load, but the heaviness was different, as though everything had been constructed to bear weights unseen. Could it simply be that Shykol had once ruled from this place? Like most Enrithi children, a commune had been weaned on tales of the lecherous old king. Behave, his mother always warned, or he will find you, do unspeakable things. A commune waited, doing his best to ignore Esmanet, who sat on a gilded chair not 4 paces to his left. He stood on the broad arc of what had been the dais of the primary audience hall. A series of steps and a ring of pilasters, their false lintels still intact, separated it from the great floor. According to the tractate, the Zarashi kings had ruled from their beds, and Shykol in particular was famed for making sport with children as his court peered through the shears ringing his dais. Knowing the way histories tended to paint their antagonists, a commune had always dismissed the tale as propaganda. But there, dead center in the dais, was an ancient stone footing for what looked like a bed. Probably an altar of some kind. Across the great floor below, the great and lesser names milled beneath the fat columns, decked in the regalia of the lands they had conquered. White banners bearing the Tusk and Circumfix in black and gold had been roped between the freestanding columns about them. The rumble of their talk thinned. Wondering whether they had glimpsed Kellis, a commune glanced over his shoulder, following the stair that rose from the dais's rear to the ruined gallery above and behind him. He saw nothing of Kellis, though he spied something, a point of fluttering black, hanging over the distant network of streets and alleyways that rose up into the haze. He blinked, frowning. Was that the mark, he sensed? A sorcerous bird? "We have arrived," a resonant voice called. Startled, Akamian glanced back to the stair, saw Kellis descend to the first landing, his beard plaited in the fashion of ancient Shear, his white vestments chased with shimmering gold. It was strange, even terrifying, to sense the mark on him as well. It dirtied him somehow, even as it augured an unthinkable future. Akamian turned back to the sky, but the bird was nowhere to be seen. "At long last," Kellis continued, casually descending the final turn of the stair, "we tread the very ground of Scripture." Akamian's thoughts raced. What should he do? Was the consult planning an attack, or was it simply the Scarlet Spires up to some damnable scarlet mischief? He resolved to remain wary, to ignore the tidal pull of Kellis's oratory. The warrior prophet crossed the dais to Esmanette, placed what seemed a luminous hand on her shoulder. "From this very place," he said, "old Shykol looked to his debauched court and asked, 'Who is this menial who speaks as king?'" He gestured to ruined Carioth, an expansive wave. "From this very place, here, Shykol raised the gilded thigh bone. He judged my brother." As always, Kellis spoke as though his words had no significance outside the truth that shone through them, as though they were consumed by their meaning. "Attend only to these simple things," his tone said, "and you shall be astonished." Akamian struggled to remain alert. "At long last, we holy travelers, we men of the Tusk, tread the very ground of Scripture." Kellis's expression darkened, and he looked about, to the lintel hanging above, to the columns queued across the floors before him. What had been hushed expectation escalated into something more profound, as though all present had become as breathless as the stone about them. This is the very house of my brother's oppressor. This is the house of he who would murder Inri Sejanus, asking, "Who is this menial who speaks as king?" Think of how far we have come. Think of all the lands, both sumptuous and severe. Think of all the steaming cities. Think of all that we have conquered. And now we have arrived at the very gates. He reached out to the eastern haze with his right hand, and again Akamian saw it, the disk of ethereal gold, the halo. Someone cried out in rapture. "One last horizon!" Kellis cried, his voice at once rumbling from the skies and whispering into every ear. "One last horizon, and we shall see the sacred land. One final march, and at last, at long last, we shall raise sword and song to Holy Shima. Even now, we rewrite the Scripture of this place." The greater and lesser names, who had watched rapt, erupted in shouts of ardor and worship, and Akamian could not but wonder what they must sound like to the Garothans skulking the alleys below, the mad conquerors. "Never!" Kellis thundered. "Never has the world seen such a band as we men of the Tusk." Suddenly he swept his sword, certainty, from its sheath. It glared milk-white in the sun. Akamian watched its reflected light bounce across the lords of the Holy War. Men squinted and blinked. "We are the God's own knife, cast in the crucible of plague, thirst, and starvation, tempered by the hammers of war, doused in the blood of countless enemies. We," he trailed without warning, smiled as though caught in the commission of some harmless vice. "It is the wont of men to boast," he said ruefully. "Who among us hasn't whispered lies in a maiden's ear?" Laughter rumbled through the headless pillars. "Anything that might make them ponder the swing of our kilts." More laughter, this time booming. Gone was the high oratory. The warrior prophet had become the Prince of Atrithau, the wry and even-handed peer. He shrugged, grinned like a man among those about to drink. Even still, what is. War watches through our eyes. Doom itself echoes in our call. What is. The glory of our undertaking will outshine that belonging to any of our forefathers. It will be a beacon through the ages. It will astonish and gratify, and yea, it will even outrage. It will be recited by 1,000,000 lips. It will be committed to memory, and the children of our children's children will take up their ancestor lists and invoke our names with reverence and awe, for they shall know their blood is blessed. Blessed by our greatness. We men of the Tusk are more. We are giants. Giants! Roaring exultation. Captured by the momentum of his words, Akamian found himself crying out as well. Wry to resounding, from where had this bursting passion come? He saw tears course down Esmanet's cheek. So who? Kellis bellowed through the trailing thunder. Who is this menial who speaks as king? Sudden silence. The buckled stone with its lattice of weeds and grasses seemed to hum. The warrior prophet held out both shining hands, a welcome, an appeal, a breathtaking benediction, and he whispered, I am. Without exception, men submitted to the hierarchy of the moving and the immovable. They stood upon the earth, they traveled over the land. But with Kellis, even this fundamental orthodoxy was upended. With his every step, he seemed to carry the world with him. So when he descended the dais and gestured to Inkiri Gotian to lead the lords of the holy war in prayer, it seemed the world itself was bent. As the intonations boomed between the walls, Akamian blinked the sweat from his eyes. Breathed deep the humid air. He thought of Esmanet lying with such a man, and he found himself fearing for her, as if she were a petal falling into a great fire. He's a prophet. So what did that make of Akamian's hate? From paths cut through the scree, slaves produced a long table and several chairs, which they set in the centermost aisle between the columns for Kellis and the great names. With a Tuscan circumfix hanging above, they sat as if for a ritual dinner, though they drank only watered wine. Akamian stood rigid throughout the ensuing discussions. It seemed surreal, but it was the conquest of Amotu they plotted, the approaches to Shaima. What Kellis had said earlier was true. They had arrived. Almost. The proceedings were remarkably civil. Gone were the days of bickering fueled by wounded or overweening pride. Even if Sauvon and Confess had been present, Akamian couldn't imagine any of the great names resorting to their old antics. Kellis dwarfed them in a manner so absolute that much as children, they had lost all care for the cubits between them. They were his unto death, kings and disciples. Disagreements arose, to be certain. But the dissenters were neither scorned nor judged for merely expressing contrary opinions. As Kellis himself said, where truth was tyrant, the clear-eyed need fear no oppression. Proyas especially asked hard questions, and old Gothjelk somehow managed to restrict his outbursts to exasperated groans. Only Kinjoza seemed to play with his number stick beneath his hand. Reasons were demanded and given, alternatives were explored and criticized, and, as though by magic, the best way seemed to unfold of its own volition. Prince Hulwarga was given the honor of the van, since it was deemed that his Thunieri would be the most able to weather any possible Fainim surprise. Count Palatine Kinjoza and his Einani, along with Proyas and his Conryans, were to constitute the Holy War's main body. They would march directly on Shaima, gathering food and siege materials as they went. Gotian and the Shrial Knights were to ride with them, as the personal guard of the warrior prophet and his sacral retinue. Earl Gothjelk and his Tidoni, meanwhile, were given the task of isolating and overcoming Cargido, the Kyrenian Age fortress that commanded the southwestern reaches of the Amati and Zarashi frontier. No one, not even Kellis, seemed to know what the heathen had planned. All reports, especially those provided by the Scarlet Spires through Kinjoza, suggested that the Sukkadi, the Kishorim, would not abandon Shaima. This meant that Fenial would either contest their advance into Amotu or fall back on the Holy City. Either way, he would give battle. The survival of the Kishorim hung in the balance, which meant the survival of Kian hung in the balance. There could be no doubt that even now Fenial mustered all possible means to overthrow them. Though Proyas counseled caution, the warrior prophet was adamant. The holy war must strike with all haste. "We diminish," he said, "while they grow." Several times Akamian dared glance at Esmanet in her nearby seat. A string of discreet functionaries came and went, kneeling at her side, either asking questions or bearing tidings. By and large, however, she remained attentive to the discussions on the floor before her. Akamian found himself studying the white-robed Nesenti, who stood in a group immediately behind their warrior prophet, Werjau and Geomakri, foremost among them. And the strangeness of it dawned on him, the way the Holy War, which had been little more than a migratory invasion led by a raucous council of chieftains, had somehow reorganized itself into an imperial court. This was no council of great and lesser names. Kellis merely consulted his generals, nothing more. All of them had been redeployed. And true to Benjuka, the rules governing their conduct had been completely rewritten. Even the ones that held Akamian motionless, here as vizier to a prophet. It was too absurd. The sun hung low over the humid countryside by the time Kellis dissolved the council. His head buzzing from the heat, Akamian waited out the obligatory prayers and rounds of self-congratulation. The combination of sun and inaction made him want to scream. Perversely, he found himself hoping that the bird from earlier did omen some kind of consult attack. Anything but this stage. Then, as if everyone had suddenly found themselves in agreement, the council was over. The stone hollows between the ruins rumbled with shouts of greeting and casual conversation. Rubbing his neck, Akamian walked to the dais steps and unceremoniously dropped to his rump. He could feel Esmanet's gaze prickle the small of his back, but Inrithi caste nobles were already climbing the dais to pay her homage, and he was too weary to do much more than pad the sweat from his face with his saffron sleeves. A hand brushed his shoulder, as though someone had thought to clasp him, but then reconsidered. Akamian turned to see Proyas. With his deep brown skin and silk kalat, he could have been a Kianine prince. "Akka," he said with a perfunctory nod. "Proyas." An awkward moment passed between them. "I thought I should tell you," he said, obviously discomfited. "You should see Zin."
"Did he send you?"
The prince shook his head. He looked strange, far more mature, with his beard grown and plaited. "He asks about you," he said lamely. "You should go see—"
"I cannot,"
Akamian replied, far more sharply than he had wished. "I'm all that stands between Kellis and the consult. I can't leave his side." Proyas's eyes narrowed in anger, but Akamian could not help but think that something had broken within the man. With Zynemus, he had abandoned seeking penance on his terms. He was someone who would no longer discriminate between afflictions. He would bear everything if he could.
"You've left his side before," Proyas said evenly. "Only at his request and against my objections."
Why this sudden need to punish? Now that Proyas required something of him, he was compelled to show him a reflection of his own callous disregard, to visit his own sins upon him. Even still, even after all Kellis had taught him, Akamian carried the old ledgers in his heart, continued to tick off settled scores.
"Why do I always do this?"
Proyas blinked, pursed his lips as though about sour teeth.
"You should go see Zynemus," he said, this time making no attempt to disguise his bitterness.
He left without saying farewell. Too numb to think, Akamian watched the assembled caste nobles. Gaedeki and Angiaban fenced jokes, no surprise there. Orissus stammered to keep up. Sometimes he alone seemed unchanged from Momum.
Gotian upbraided some young Shrile knight. Soter and several other Ainani seemed to be laughing at the sight of Uranyanka kissing the warrior prophet's knee. Hulwarga stood mute in the shadow of his dead brother's groom, Yalgrota. Everybody talking and belonging, forming little interlocking circles like the links of some greater armor. The thought struck Akamian without warning. I'm alone. He knew nothing of his family, save that his mother was dead. He despised his school almost as much as his school despised him. He had lost his every student in one way or another to the blasted gods, as Manette had betrayed him. He coughed and swallowed, cursed himself for a fool. He called out to a passing slave, a surly-looking adolescent, told him to fetch some unwatered wine. See, he thought to himself as the boy ran off, you have one friend. His forearms against his knees, he stared down at his sandals, frowned at his untrimmed toenails. He thought of Zynemus. I should see him. He did not turn when the shadow joined him, sitting on the steps. The air suddenly smelled of myrrh. Somewhere, in a treacherous and juvenile part of his soul, he leapt with joy, even though he knew it wasn't Esmanette. The shadow was too dark. Is it time? Akamian asked. Soon, Kellis said. Akamian had come to fear their nightly sessions with the Gnosis. To intuitively grasp logic or arithmetic might be a thing of wonder, but to do the same with ancient war cants was something altogether different. How could he not dread when the man so effortlessly outran his ability to compare or categorize? What troubles you, Akka? What do you think? Something within him spat. Instead, he turned to Kellis and asked, Why Shaima? The clear blue eyes studied him in silence. You say you've come to save us, Akamian pressed. You admit as much. So then why, when our doom resides in Golgotharoth, do we continue on to Shaima? You're tired, Kellis said. Perhaps we should resume our studies tomorrow. I'm fine, Akamian snapped, only to be dismayed by his presumption. Sleep and mandate schoolmen, he added lamely, are old enemies. Kellis nodded, smiled sadly. Your grief, it still overcomes you. For some treacherous reason, Akamian said, Yes. The numbers of Enrithi had dwindled. Several personages had gathered at a discreet distance, obviously awaiting Kellis, but he dismissed them with a gesture. Soon Akamian and Kellis were quite alone, sitting side by side on the dais's lip, watching the shadows swell and congregate in the crotches of the surrounding ruin. A dry wind dropped from the skies, and for a time Akamian closed his eyes, savoring its cool kiss across his skin, listening to it whisper through the sumacs that thronged beyond the floor. An occasional bee buzzed in and out of hearing. It reminded Akamian of hiding from his father in the gullies far from the beaches, the hush concealed between the throng of living things, the sense of slowing light, the limitless sky. It seemed a moment outside consequence, where the profound repose of what was put flight to all thoughts of past or future. He could even smell the stone as it cooled in the lengthening shadows. It seemed impossible that Shai Cole had dwelt in this place. Did you know, Kellis said, that there was a time when I listened to the world and heard only noise? No, I didn't. Kellis raised his face to the sky, closed his eyes. Sunlight curled into the silky depths of his hair. I know different now. There's more than noise, Akka. There is voice. Shivers unrolled like wet strings across Akamian's skin. His eyes fixed on the horizon, Kellis pressed his palms across his thighs, drawing folds into arcs. Against the silk, Akamian thought he glimpsed the golden disks about his fingers. Tell me, Akka, Kellis said. When you look into a mirror, what do you see? He spoke as a bored child might. Akamian shrugged. Myself. A teacher's indulgent look. Are you so certain? Do you see yourself looking through your eyes, or do you simply see your eyes? Strip away your assumptions, Akka, and ask yourself, what do you really see? My eyes, he admitted. I simply see my eyes.
Then you don't see yourself.
A commune could only stare at his profile, dumbfounded. Kellis's grin shouted intellectual mischief. So where are you, if you can't be seen?
Here, a commune replied after a moment of hesitation.
I'm here.
And just where is this here?
It's... He frowned for a moment. It's here, inside what you see.
Here? But how could you be here, Kellis laughed, when I'm here and you're over there?
But... A commune scratched his beard in exasperation. You play games with words, he exclaimed.
Kellis nodded, his expression at once cryptic and bemused. Imagine, he said, that you could take the great ocean, in all its immensity, and fold it into the form and proportion of a man. There are depths, Akka, that go in rather than down, in without limit. What you call the outside lies within us, and it's everywhere. This is why, no matter where we stand, it's always here. No matter where we dare tread, we always stand in the same place.
Metaphysics, a commune realized. He spoke of metaphysics. Here, a commune repeated. You're saying here is a place, outside place?
Indeed.
Your body is your surface, nothing more, the point where your soul breaches this world. Even now, as we look upon each other from across this span, from two different places, we also stand in the same place, the same nowhere. I watch myself through your eyes, and you watch yourself through mine, though you know it not.
Somehow, at some point, insight had become a species of horror. He fairly stammered.
We're the same person?
Kellis was speaking this madness. Kellis! Person? It would be more precise to say we're the same here. But, in a manner, yes. Just as there's but one here, there's but one soul, Akka, breaching the world in many different places, and almost always failing to apprehend itself as itself.
Nilnameshi foolishness, it had to be.
This is just metaphysics. He said, the very instant Kellis whispered,
This is just metaphysics.
A commune gaped at the man, utterly dumbstruck. His heart hammered, as though struggling to recover its rhythm through violence of action. For a moment he tried telling himself that Kellis alone had spoken, but the taste of the words was too fresh on his tongue. The silence whined with a strange horror. A sense of dislocation unlike any he had ever experienced, a sense of things once sacred and intact, now broken. Just who had spoken? The world reeled through refracted sunlight. He is me. How else could he know what he knows?
As though nothing untoward had happened, Kellis said.
Tell me, how can some words work miracles while others can't?
A commune swallowed. Tried to recover himself in his knowledge.
The non-men once believed it was the language that made sorcery possible, but when men began reproducing their cants and bastard tongues, it became clear this wasn't so.
He breathed deeply, realizing that with this one question, Kellis had made plain not only a commune's ignorance, but the ignorance of every sorcerer living. I really do understand nothing.
It's the meanings, he continued. The meanings are different somehow. No one knows why.
Kellis nodded and looked down to the hem of his robe. When he glanced up, a commune found his brilliant eyes impossible to match.
The word love, he said. Does it mean what it has always meant, or is the meaning different for you?
Reward the intellect and punish the heart. It was always the same with Kellis.
What are you saying?
That the meaning is different because what it recollects is different. Esmanet.
So you're suggesting that sorcerous words recollect something other words do not?
A commune asked this with more heat than he'd intended. Derision had stolen across his expression.
But what could words remember? Words aren't...
He trailed, his voice silenced by sudden understanding.
One soul. Not words, Akka. You.
What could you remember that might make miracles of mere words?
I don't understand.
But you do.
Akamian blinked at the preposterous tears in his eyes. He thought of the Scarlet Spires and their compound in Iothea, of the world flying apart beneath his outstretched fingers, and he remembered the meanings that had thundered from his chest and soul, his world-racking song, compelling fire from empty air, light from shadow, and the obliteration of all that offended, the words that were his calling, his curse, the words that exacted the impossible. Penance from the world. How could a mere man say such things?
We kneel before idols, Kellis was saying. We hold open our arms to the sky. We beseech the distances, clutch at the horizon. We look outward, Akka, always outward, for what lies within.
He splayed a hand against his chest.
For what lies here, in this clearing that we share?
The sun had crossed the crimson threshold. The air seemed to purple, and the ruins were burnished in failing reds. The earlier breeze had faded to a sun-warm draft.
The god, Akamian said, but the voice was not his own.
You're saying that this one soul that looks out from behind all our eyes is the god.
Even though he spoke these words, even though he knew quite well what they meant, they escaped him somehow, fell from him without force of thought or comprehension. Akamian clutched his shoulders, felt a shudder pass through his portly frame.
We are all God,
Kellis said, now both solemn and enthused, like a father heartening a beaten son.
The God is always here, watching through your very own eyes and from the eyes of those about you. But we forget who we are, and we begin to think of here as another there, detached, isolate, abject before the immensities of the world. We forget. But we don't all forget equally.
Kellis fixed him with an implacable look.
Those who forget the least, we call the few.
There had been a moment, walking the fiery hallways of Iothea, when Akamian's wrath had been checked, when he'd faltered, realizing he no longer recognized himself. He had cried out in Seswatha's voice and had uttered words that had transcended the circle of even that ancient individuality, cants that had made milk of what was hard, what was real. Who had he been? Who?
To speak sorcery, Akka, is to speak words that recollect the truth.
Truth, Akamian numbly repeated. He understood what Kellis said. He knew, and yet something within him refused to grasp.
What truth?
That this place behind our face, though separated by nations and ages, is the same place, the same here. That each of us witnesses the world through innumerable eyes. That we are the God we would worship.
And it seemed to Akamian that he could remember, that across sea, mountain, and plain, he saw the god blink 1,000 times before 1,000 hearths. A daughter gazing upon her slumbering father, an ancient wife clutching her husband's arm in spotted hands, a man spitting blood, beating an earthen floor in anguish, here, now, in this one place. How else could one explain the cants of calling or compulsion? How else could one explain Seswatha's dreams?
For so long, Kellis was saying, you thought yourself a pariah, an outcast, and though your tongue was ever ready to accost those who would condemn you, you lived in shame. You would watch them and you would curse yourself for hoping, always stronger in the estimation of others, so they seemed, always so certain, and always unable to see, the fools, how extraordinary you truly were. They spat when they looked upon you. They laughed, and though you made their derision evidence of their stupidity, in the secret moments you grieved, you wept, and you asked, why must I be cursed? Why must I be damned?
And Akamian thought, he is
me.
Kellis smiled, and somehow, impossibly, Akamian saw Inrau in the iridescent cast of his look.
We are each other. But I'm broken. Something's wrong with me. Because you're a pious man born to a world unable to fathom your piety. But all that changes with me, Akka. The old revelations have outlived the age of their intention, and I have come to reveal the new. I am the shortest path, and I say that you are not damned. Through the tumult of passion that rocked him, something old and arcane whispered the mandate catechism. Though you lose your soul, you shall gain the... But Kellis was talking again, speaking in intonations that seemed to resonate across the warm evening air, to ring out from the very heart of things. A sorcerer's words work miracles because they recall the god. Think, Akka, what does it mean to see the world as sorcerers see it? What does it mean to apprehend the Anta? The many see the world through one pair of eyes. They grasp creation from but a single vantage, one angle among many. But the few, those who recollect, no matter how imperfectly, the god's voice, possess an intimation of many angles, a memory of the thousand eyes that look out from this clearing we call here. As a result, everything they see is transformed, shadowed by insinuations of more. And think of the mark. For the many, sorcery is indistinguishable from the world, and how could it be otherwise, given they apprehend the world from but a single angle? For a man who cannot move, the facade simply is the temple. But for the few who glimpse many angles, sorcery must reek of incompleteness. For where the god's true voice speaks to the totality of angles, the few are constrained by the murk and imperfection of their recollections. They can conjure facades only. It seemed so obvious. All the analogies of sorcerers as blasphemers, as abusers of the divinity within, as those who ape the god's sacred song, were but crude approximations, tenuous glimpses of a truth that Kellis held in his lap. And the Kisharim? Akamian found himself saying. What of them? The warrior prophet shrugged. Think of the way a fire will shroud the world in the course of illuminating a camp. Often the light of what we see blinds us, and we come to think there is one angle and one angle only. Though they know it not, this is why the Kisharim blind themselves. They douse the fire of their eyes, pluck the one angle they see, to better grasp the many they recollect. They sacrifice the subtle articulations of knowledge for the inchoate profundities of intuition. They recall the tone and timbre, the passion of the god's voice, to near perfection, even as the meanings that make up true sorcery escape them. And there it was, the mysteries of the Sukkah, which had baffled sorcerous thinkers for centuries, dispelled in a handful of words. The warrior prophet turned to him, clutched his shoulder with a shining hand. The truth of here is that it is everywhere. And this, Akka, is what it means to be in love, to recognize the here within the other, to see the world through another's eyes, to be here together. His eyes, luminous with wisdom, seemed unbearable. The world had sloughed off the last of the sun, and the shadows pooled like ink. Night stalked the ruined ways of Kerioth. And this is why you suffer so. When what was here turns away from you, as she has turned away from you, it seems there's nowhere you might stand. A mosquito dared whine through the air about their ears.
Why are you telling me this?
Akamian cried. Because you are not alone. Slavery agreed with her. Even more than Yell or Burulan, Fanashila adored her new station in life. Fussing over her mistress in the mornings, snoozing in the afternoons, then fussing over her mistress again in the evenings. The gold, the perfume, the silk, the cosmetics Lady Esmanette let them use. The intimations of power, great power. The delicacies Lady Esmanette let them taste. Fanashila was Fami, one of the original slaves from the Fama Palace in Karaskand. How could the freedom to chase goats compare with this? Of course, Opsara cursed them whenever she could, the vicious old hag, They're idolaters, slavers. We must cut their throats, not kiss their toes.
Over and over and on, but then Upsara had Kianine blood in her. She was an Uftaka, and everyone knew that Uftaki were nothing more than menials who strutted like nobles. Their own kind even despised them. What did that say? Besides, for all Upsara's talk, her ward, the infant Moengus, seemed healthy enough. Fanashila even said as much one night in the slave mess. They had been sitting in their accustomed corner, the one that marked their importance, mildly fingering rice from their bowls while Upsara ranted about killing their Enrithi masters.
Well, Fanashila blurted, you go first.
How Yell and the others had howled with laughter. Without realizing, Fanashila had found the way to shut Upsara up. Now she fairly shook with pride and giggles whenever Upsara started, because she knew her moment would shine again. If anything troubled Fanashila, it was the kneeling, when the overseers gathered her and the others and brought them to the Umbilica shrine. First, a shrial priest delivered a sermon, only bits and pieces of which Fanashila could understand. Then they were forced to pray aloud to the half-circle of idols. Some were grotesque, like the severed head of Ancus upon a golden tree. Others were obscene, like a jockley with his chin propped upon his phallus, and several were even beautiful, like stern Gilgeol or voluptuous Gira, though the wide-thrown ankles of the latter made Fanashila blush. The shrial priest called them aspects of the god, but Fanashila knew better. They were demons. But she prayed to them nonetheless, just as she was told. Sometimes, when the overseers were distracted, she would look away from the leering devil before her and search the brocaded panels that regaled the tarp walls for the two scimitars of Fane. They were all over, little signs of her people's faith. Then she would silently repeat the word she had heard so many times in tabernacle. One for the unbeliever, one for the unseeing eye. This, she decided, had to be enough. What harm could there be in praying to demons when the solitary god commanded all? Besides, the demons listened. They actually answered their prayers. Why else would the idolaters be the slavers, and the faithful the slaves? After evening mess, the overseers herded the women to the room of mats, the large tent where they slept across fantastic carpets, which had been looted, the overseers said, from the strongholds of their dead Kianine masters. Some wept at night. Others, particularly those who were beautiful or those who caused trouble, were taken away in the dead of night. Sometimes they returned, sometimes not. But as far as Fanashila was concerned, they brought it on themselves. One need only do. It was as simple as that. Do, and you will be rewarded, or at the very least, left alone. This was what she reminded herself of the night she was taken away. Everything they told her, she did. That was the rule. They wouldn't make her disappear. Not her. She had washed the feet of their warrior prophet. Lady Esmanette would never allow it. Never. The overseer, Koropos, a former Sarangi slave of the Kianine, refused to answer any of her whispered questions. With a firm hand, he guided her between the forms sprawled sleeping across the floor, then into the antechamber where the overseers slept and gamed. At first, she assumed that they wanted to bed her. She had seen their evil grins when they watched her, especially that of Tyrius, the freed Nansur. They had raped many of the others. But would they dare to spoil her? All she had to do was cry to Lady Esmanette, and their throats would be cut. She said as much to Koropos.
Tell him,
the wiry old man snorted. With that, he shoved her through the curtain of hanging whips, the traditional entrance for Enrithi slave quarters, into the cool night air. A man stood, tall and indomitable, in the night gloom. Beyond him, the encampment spread dark and labyrinthine across the distances. Because of the anonymous simplicity of his dress, a desert tunic beneath a Sarangi kalmus, several heartbeats passed before she recognized him. Lord Werjau of the Nesenti. She fell to her knees, chin to her breastbone, as she had been trained.
Look at me, he said, his tone firm yet gentle. Tell me, my sweet, what's this rumor I hear? Relief swept through her. Fanashila looked away demurely. She loved gossip, almost as much as attention.
What rumor would that be, my lord?
Werjao smiled down at her, stood so perilously near she could smell the sour of his crotch. He brought a calloused thumb to her chin. She shuddered as he traced the outline of her lips.
That they are lovers still, he said.
Though his gaze remained remote, something seemed to smirk in his tone. Fanashila swallowed, afraid once again.
They?
She asked, blinking tears.
Who?
The prophet consort and the holy tutor.